Thank you all very much for coming out this morning. As we were just talking up here in August, it's always tough to get people together and away from the beaches and to the round tables. But it seems that Andrew has a very full plate this week of various events around town. But he was gracious enough to agree to come to CSIS and talk off the record, sort of a private round table, about Taiwan's perspectives on the China threat. I don't know if there are any journalists here. I didn't look at the list, but if anyone wants to quote, I suppose, just go up to Andrew afterwards and ask. I don't know if we want to make sure that that this is off the record for so that we're all candid in discussing this important issue. I think you all know Andrew and his background. He's probably one of the most astute observers of China and military affairs across the strait in Taiwan. So when we heard he was coming to town, we know him as sort of a friend, and we see him when we go to Taipei. But we wanted to take advantage of the opportunity and give you all an opportunity as well to talk to him in person about the way things are moving. Obviously, there's a lot of events within Taiwan nowadays. Every day there's a new political development that is sort of spinning our heads here in Washington, trying to follow it all. And it's going to be rather dramatic, I suppose, running right through March. And in China as well, it's an election year, you can say, with a 17-party Congress. So there's a lot to look at and discuss and think about in the complexities of cross-strait relations. And as I say, there's no one better than Andrew to sort of walk us through this. And hopefully we can have sort of an open roundtable discussion. Mike Green will be joining us. We have Bonnie Glazer here as well, who's a senior associate here at CSIS. It mentions that we're going to be commentators. There's nothing, I think, so formal in being commentators. Hopefully it'll be sort of question, discussion. All of us will jump in and make our comments, given the talent around the table. So with that, let me turn to Andrew for maybe 10 or 15 minutes, and then we'll open it up.
Thank you, Derek. It's always a great pleasure to be here, to meet old friends, and thank you for your kind and very gracious introduction. And I want to also thank CSIS to put up this small panel for our discussion, and Bates has specifically laid out the areas for people to chew up, and hopefully that I can make my contribution to look into the evolving Taiwanese views on the Chinese threats. This will be my personal views. I'm not convening government's views or whatever, but I, based on my successive observation of this issue throughout my study and my interaction with government officials and other experts in Taiwan. Fundamentally, I think that if you look at that starting from 2004 and so, when Taiwan conducted this referendum on the missiles issues along with the presidential election, and of course the referendum on the missile issues was failed, will not be passed, but it also symbolized the dilemma and the complexity of the defense issues in Taiwan. The defense issues or the perception over the threats from China is always hampered and complex by two major issues in Taiwan. One is how to look at China. And because on one hand, we have a robust economic and social interactions with China, and it's continued to grow. And the reality of interdependence economically, and there are millions of people spending visiting mainland China, makes people consider that we should have a more constructive and productive relations with China. That's the perception. That it will be a very important factor affecting the people's perception developing the threats from China. And secondly, will be the domestic politics. I think the China threat has been divided and openly been play around by political jargons in Taiwan, not only in terms of the party positions over these issues, but also in terms of what kind of threats that we should look at China. And of course, the missiles are staged offshore, putting targeting on Taiwan is perceived as immediate threats. But a lot of people don't believe that China is going to use missiles against Taiwan. If you look at the survey conducted in 2005, and I think that survey result is still valid in Taiwan today, it was conducted by Taiwanese Business Week, in October 2005. Basically, it asks three questions. One is, do you believe China is going to use force against Taiwan? A lot of people, majority of people, over 70% across the board, across the age differences, do not believe China is going to use force against Taiwan. Over 70% of the survey questions. And second question is, do you consider Taiwan come up with the sizable or suitable defense against Chinese attack? Over 70% do not believe Taiwan has the ability to fend off a Chinese military attack. Okay, that's the another results we should pay attention to. And thirdly, when China comes to attack Taiwan, if that is the case, do you believe the United States will come to Taiwan's rescue or assist Taiwan to fend off China attack? Over 75% people in Taiwan believe that the United States will definitely come to Taiwan's rescue and intervene and fend off Chinese military attack. So you can see this very polarized and conflicting results regarding China's threat among the populations in Taiwan. And I consider this still valid today because a lot of people don't believe China is going to use force because why they want to use force and create disasters for both sides. Why do they use force to destroy Taiwan and at the same time destroy their own economy? And their people will suffer. You know, it's a logical, rational analysis. So people still don't believe that they are going to use force against Taiwan because they will suffer and we will suffer, and nobody is out of it. Yeah. Therefore, this is the constituency's perception. That makes it very difficult for the Defense Department, the DOD in Taiwan, to sell their case in front of the parliament, because if they want to say, we want to buy this weapon system, we want to fend off the Chinese threat, the way they are organizing their arguments seems to me, if you look at the Legislative Gazette throughout the years, Ministry of National Defense in Taiwan never put up a very good case to defend their defense construction or the weapon system acquisition, because simply you cannot answer the question why you consider China is going to use force, whether the military attack over Taiwan is imminent. It is the dilemma and challenge will continue to be faced by the Ministry of National Defense in the future. And what would be the trend in the future? That is not to say Taiwanese politicians or the leadership or people do not concern about defense. They do. They certainly want a affordable, credible defense in Taiwan. They certainly want to continue this modernization to deter any kind of threats. I mean, security is still number one priority for Taiwanese people. But the way to design or to put up a defense program, they have different views. So it requires a lot of discussions. But the problem is, do we have an adequate platform in Taiwan to invite all sides to have a rational and sensible discussion over this issue? To me, in the past 4 years or 5 years, we don't have, we just lack of this kind of platform to induce rational discussion over the defense issues. Even the MND, the Ministry of National Defense, do not assist to put out such a platform in the society to attract rational discussion over this issue. So that's the disadvantages of inducing consensus in Taiwan, and that will be continued in the future. Therefore, I do consider whoever gets elected in 2008, we still lack of this kind of structure in the society to put up a adequate platform for discussion. Without this consensus building process in the society, it will be difficult for the MND to put up any proposals in front of the legislative yuan to come up with a very constructive defense build-up in Taiwan. And second, in the future, I think will also have a strong influence over the decision making in terms of defense construction Taiwan will be the role of the legislators. You know, we are going to have an election early next year. And this time we have a legislative reform already, and the numbers of the legislature will be cut in half. So legislators will be more influential and powerful in the process. So whoever gets elected and who are hands-on defenses will have a tremendous influence. And how are they going to play the role between the legislative body and the executive body and among societies? It's another new platform to expect in the future. So that is going to be another uncertainty in terms of future decision-making over the defense procurement. And thirdly, people are looking at, I mean, this is the expectation. As long as we have a strong expectation in Taiwan to have a better and constructive and more direct relations with between Taiwan and China, and the defense or security issue will be, it's not weakened or whatever, but it will be affected. It's not a center of the attention. The center of attention in Taiwan right now is, can we have a direct linkage with mainland China after the election, after the 2008 election? There's a high expectation in Taiwan right now that we should develop more direct and constructive relations with mainland China. Based on that, it will be difficult for Taiwan to say that China is immediate imminent threat, and we should set aside the linkage issue and put the priority over the defense. So there is a gap between the social expectation and the policy-making deliberation in Taiwan right now. So in terms of developing a more mature and sensible threat images in Taiwan and to assist the defense construction in Taiwan, will face other difficulties after the election, because it will be high expectation among societies to encourage more constructive and direct linkages between two sides, and the expectations for both sides to develop this peace and security framework is also high in agenda. So with all these issues on the table, the threat perception will further be diluted and will be marginalized. So I will expect it will be difficult for the MND in Taiwan to put up yet another big defense procurement packages and to be passed by the legislative body. One, because there will be a change in legislative structure, and second, will be high expectation from the society in terms of constructing direct and better relations with mainland China. So these are the two aspects that we should look at in terms of evaluating this evolving threat perceptions in Taiwan in the near future. I think I should stop here and perhaps inviting friends to put up more questions relating to this issue, and we can talk about this later on.
Great. Thank you very much, Andrew. Just one comment, even though I said I wouldn't be a commentator. The poll numbers you mentioned reminded me of an anecdote that I experienced in Taiwan about a year and a half ago. When I went to, I think it was Myeongji University, no. Anyway, Tamjung University. I asked students, I was in a sort of a round table in the center of this room, and around the edges were students. And in the middle of it, I stopped and asked the students to get involved. And I asked them, how many here think, A, that the United States is interested in Taiwan because old friend, commitment, democracy, or B, because we want to use Taiwan as a tool to contain China, simply a tool to cap China's rise. 75% said B. 75 to 80% said B. And then I said, okay, how many of you all think that if Taiwan decided on its own it wanted to unify with the mainland, the United States would actively seek to prevent it? 60% said yes. It seemed to me from that, and that's obviously not scientific, but I do talk to people anecdotally, and people kind of nod. And some people say that's not representative. Some say, well, no, I think the average Taiwan citizen might think that. I wonder what you think about the perspective towards the United States, whether they understand in Taiwan why the United States is interested, what the U.S. perspective is on the cross-strait issue, because it seems to me rather dangerous if there's a misunderstanding, a fundamental misunderstanding about U.S. interests across the strait. And it goes to the question of 75% believing we'll come to Taiwan's aid, maybe under any circumstances and such like that, because they think we have ulterior motives. Do you see this kind of thing in Taiwan? Are you concerned about it? Do you think people really understand what the U.S. is about when it comes to cross-strait issues?
I can say over 80% or maybe more than 80% of people in Taiwan do not have adequate perception about U.S. Policy on Taiwan or on the cross-strait issues. But as I mentioned, the survey results, I think why people are so abundantly believe that the United States will come to Taiwan's rescue because, A, they consider Taiwan as a democracy, United States support democracy. And second, U.S. and Taiwan has maintained so close relations in the past, and we are actually protected by the Taiwan Relations Act. So people reading Taiwan Relations Act, United States has a commitment, obligation to assist Taiwan to its own defense. So that's the way people read at the TRA. And so they consider United States is obligatory to Taiwan's defense and security. It's written in the law, and the law has been passed by the U.S. Congress. So that's the kind of, warranty and assurance ticket that people receive, and they perceive this way. So they believe United States, whatever Taiwan do in the future, they will support a democracy because Taiwan has followed U.S. To become a democratic country. And second, we have so close relations, and there's a legal binding obligation from U.S.
Okay. Bonnie, do you have any comments on this to start, or should we just open? If you have, well, let me open it up. If you have anything you want
to
jump in quickly,
to comment if you'd like.
Comment briefly, and then we'll open it up.
What I would really like to underscore here is the issue of the dangers of miscalculation. And Andrew has just talked about the potential dangers of Taiwan sort of misjudging the United States. There's three actors here, and there is tremendous room for miscalculation on all sides. On the Chinese side, I have just come from spending 2 weeks in Beijing, where I got a real earful of about their concern about the proposed referendum to join the UN under the name of Taiwan. And I think there's many ways in which the Chinese could misjudge the situation. One is the potential for them to misjudge their own people, the sensitivity of the Taiwan issue, and whether or not the people of the mainland would rise up if Taiwan does something that has crossed China's red lines and Hu Jintao and the leadership does not respond firmly enough. And there is this perception that people will take to the streets, that it will call into question the legitimacy of the regime. So I think that's one way in which they could miscalculate. I think clearly there's a potential that China could misjudge how the United States would respond to use of force by China against Taiwan. And there are many people who are talking about the preference for using force now in a limited way that will prevent the need for using more force, potentially even all-out war with the United States if they do not do something now. It always makes me nervous when the Chinese talk about various coercive steps that they could take and how they would judge the reaction of Taiwan, of the United States, of Japan, other members of the international community. And there is this sense of confidence that escalation would be controlled. And they just hit a few targets and everything would return to normal, and China would be able to stick with its peaceful reunification policy because if they don't do something, they fear, or the argument goes, that the peaceful reunification policy would come under great pressure in China. And again, that goes to the issue of how they read the domestic situation and the people. There's clearly a possibility that the United States may misjudge this situation as well, and so miscalculation is our problem, too. How far will Taiwan press independence? Can we correctly predict what Chen Shui-bian and what future leaders will do? And, of course, we could misjudge China's response. We may not fully comprehend China's estimate of the situation, its bottom line. We may overestimate its tolerance and underestimate the leadership's need for credibility on this issue. So there's great potential here, and we are actually, I think, sort of moving into a period of sort of heightened alarm in Beijing, which will get people here more worked up and more attentive to the problem, that may be somewhat similar to what we saw in late 2003, early 2004 in those elections. The Chinese are clearly putting a great deal of pressure on Washington to do more to try and stop this referendum. They are especially concerned this time because the Pan-Blue has put forward its own referendum to join the United Nations under some nomenclature that is acceptable, could be the Republic of China or something else. The Pan-Blue is seen really by Beijing as the most important force to curb the DPP and what they call the pro-independence forces in Taiwan. So I think we are really moving into a period here of, you know, greater uncertainty where the danger for miscalculation will possibly increase.
I'd like to add a few words on this, the perception of the threats, which why Taiwanese don't believe or lack of the confidence that Taiwanese military cannot fend off a Chinese attack. I have done some conversations and talked to the people, you know, with these results, and a lot of people consider one that they consider the geography is important. The distance between Taiwan and mainland China is only about 130 kilometers, and nowadays you have a most advanced weapon system available in China, missile, for example. They can conduct preemptive strikes to Taiwan anytime they want. Just push the button, and it will land it on Taiwan within 5 minutes. And they considered, how can Taiwan fend off the missile attack? And building missile defense systems so expensive, and how many missiles you need? I mean, that kind of argument will be come up with, along with this perception. You know, you simply because. There is expectation and demands. So you have to tell us how much money we should put into this, and how long can we build up a sky net or whatever, a fend off all kinds of attack. You tell us, can we do it ourselves? If we cannot, who can provide this technology for Taiwan? Can we get all kinds of all assistance we need in terms of to build this umbrella? A fan of the Chinese attack. So you have these sort of all sorts kinds of questions on the table by the people, the constituency, the taxpayers. Unfortunately, this kind of issue cannot be answered by the government, not only this government, but I don't think that people, the future government, can actually provide the adequate answers for this. So that would be one of the biggest challenges for the Defense Department, for whoever the leadership or politician who are hands-on defense issue in Taiwan, to really get the support or consensus building in Taiwan. Because this is the threat perception from the ordinary people, and they are paying tax, and they are asking questions. So you have to fulfill their expectation or their anxiety. You have to, you know, put up a good case in terms of continue to get the support for their acquisitions.
Wayne Schroeder, Lockheed Martin. I remember coming here, I think, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and Admiral Keating was here and discussed some of the dialogue that he had had with the Chinese military based on some trips that he had taken. And if I recall correctly, please correct me if I misstate this, he mentioned that one of the first things out of the Chinese mouths was their concept was in the long term, well, U.S., you can have an interest in the Eastern Pacific, but we really want to have that interest in the Western Pacific. This is what really is, I think, driving the Chinese, the overall Chinese perspective. So it's not just limited to Taiwan. It takes a broader concept over the entire relationship of the U.S. with Japan, with Korea, with the Philippines, with all of the Western Pacific. So I would hope that when we talk about this issue, we take it in that context. If they move our, if you will, defense perimeter, to use that phrase going back to the 1950s, outside of Taiwan, that would be their first step, really, to drive the United States out of a broader engagement in security relationships in all the Western Pacific. So I would look at it first in that way and would like your thoughts on that. But then also, Mr. Kang, it seems to me in discussing this, we have something of a catch-22 situation here. If the United States is expected to come to Taiwan's defense, but Taiwan itself doesn't want to increase its defense responsibilities, that puts this whole issue almost entirely, it seems to me, upon U.S. policy. Because if Taiwan does not want to counter in any way, and I can certainly understand what you're saying with respect to the missile defense buildup and how that is being perceived, then the relationship here becomes one more of relying on the United States, and that puts U.S. policy, I think, in a much more difficult position versus being able to work with Taiwan and perhaps others in the region.
I totally agree with you, sir. I think that there, I think I would say this is there's a gap of perceptions. The essence of the problem is people in Taiwan, their perception is so different from yours in a way. I mean, in terms of burden sharing or in terms of threats. I think there's a room to maneuver is that. If you want to have people in Taiwan to support the kind of defense build up and consider to be the most very important, vitally important for the United States to support, continue to support Taiwan security in the future, and you have to come up with the argument to convince the people in Taiwan. Not just the politicians, and politicians, they also receive the same kind of question from the constituencies. Mm-hmm. And they cannot justify their case. That's the reason for not passing all kinds of defense procurement in the past. So I think the United States should find out what is the core problem in Taiwan, because the taxpayers, the constituents, they have a lot of questions on the table. But the Taiwanese government or the defense planners, they cannot fulfill the answers to answer adequately to those questions that demanded from the bottom up. So that's the problem here. Therefore, it's difficult to have a consensus building. If you don't have a consensus building process, how can you come up with a unified in the policy decision making over the defense issue? It's difficult. And I consider this is important. Now, you open up a new horizon. If you want to create parallel perceptions, parallel concerns between United States and Taiwan in terms of defending the interest in this region. And you have to come up with the unanimous or the similar momentums of threat building perceptions and communicating with each other. I think that's very important. So the channel communication is not to the Taiwanese leaders or Taiwanese politicians. You have to convey the message to the society as well, to the experts, to and encourage Taiwan to build up a adequate platform for discussion of these issues, because this is an issue involving everybody to come up with their support, not just decision makers or politicians.
Another aspect of this, too, is in the United States, you know how you get support in the legislature for defense. Bill Dubbs put different elements in different constituencies, so congressmen or senators have a voting interest, a constituent interest in keeping these things going. And there's been discussion of that as well, of having more offsets, so that it means jobs for constituents of certain LY members. So it's not simply defense, but it means jobs. It means economic development. It means so this is something I know the Pentagon has thought about. We've thought about as well, is how does it normally work in these in democracies to keep support for defense? And that's one way, and maybe there could be more done in that realm to make it of interest, aside from the pure security aspects, which clearly there needs to be a better discussion on that realm as well.
Andrew, thank you for your comments. I'm Dave Brown from SICE. I have two questions, if I can get away with it. Tell me if I'm beyond my realm. The first has to do with what's the impact on public opinion in Taiwan about defense of evidence of a deterioration of relations between Taiwan and the United States. Went through a very bad patch in 2003, 2004, before the survey that you cited. And since that survey, we've had recurring periods of stress over the unification guidelines, names, the referendum now, and the State Department, I believe, has intentionally made these disagreements public so that they would have an impact on public opinion. They would reach society, not just policymakers. The question is, has this deterioration of relations, this public evidence of it, had any impact on this belief of the public in Taiwan that come what may, America's going to come and pull, you know, come to Taiwan's assistance? Has it had any impact on the way they think about their elections? For instance, has it inclined voters to think that maybe we ought to have a government in Taipei that will have less friction with the U.S.? Or just if you could talk about that. The second question, if I can get away with it, has to do with Taiwan's development of offensive capabilities against the PRC. By this, I mean the effort to develop a missile capability that could be used against military targets. There's been public evidence, public discussion of this for a long time, and some acknowledgement by the Ministry of Defense that they're working on this. What's the public attitude? I think I can guess what it is, but what do your surveys tell you, and how does this affect their public belief about Taiwan's ability to fend off pressure from the PRC. Thank you.
Thank you, David. First question, yes. The U.S.-specific statements to address the referendum issues do have some impact over the Taiwanese opinions and in society. I think people really worry about what would be a U.S. Revenge or punishment. I mean, this is the word using in Taiwan, punishment. What would be the next U.S. punishment on Taiwan? So people consider this is a punishment from the United States. You know, they don't like punishment. And they consider you cannot actually frustrate a big country like United States as a country supporting Taiwan constantly. So people consider this is a serious matter. And you have to take very careful steps in terms of continue this process. To be frank, campaign for UN membership, I don't think a majority of people in Taiwan are interested or attracted by this issue. A lot of it has been manufactured by media reports. And a lot of it has been heavily driven by the interest group or political factions. If you ask the ordinary people, why should we go for UN? I mean, yes, Taiwan deserves to be a member of an international society. That's been going on for many years already. We've been talking this, and even international society do not agree with this issue. We still exist. And why should we do it now? What particularly this year? So people consider this is for campaign, election campaign. A lot of people believe this is only a short-lived, and no, it will not be continued in the future. This is only for the purpose of the election. So they don't care. You know, they identify this as for election purposes. So they're not paying too much attention that this is going to be another step forward for Taiwan identity or nation-building process. They don't have these very fancy, rosy political pictures in their mind. So I don't think majority of people are really seriously supporting this process. And they do consider U.S. Warning and serious responses are very important and should be taken care of carefully. And I think that that will have some effects in terms of this ongoing process in the future. Secondly,
can I comment on that just before you go on to David's second question? There was a poll that was released several weeks ago. One of the questions was the United States has clearly indicated its opposition to the referendum. Would you support it anyway? And now 70% said yes. So that shows that, I mean, well, you're arguing they care about the U.S.-Taiwan relationship. They don't care about entering the U.N., and they don't care about this referendum. If both of those were true, then why would the results to that question be 70%?
I think that's a very good observation. It may just be little countries don't like to be pushed around by big countries, and it's a sort of nationalistic reaction to pressure from the U.S., but I'm interested in Andrew's comment.
I agree with you, what you said. They don't like to be pushed around. They don't like to be pushed around either by Beijing or by Washington, D.C. I mean, there's a limit, I mean, in a way.
Andrew, could you comment on the phenomenon which people are talking about of rising anti-Americanism in Taiwan? Do you see this? Is it potentially just within maybe the dark green and the DPP? It seems to me that we are at a point where maybe certain kinds of U.S. pressure could be counterproductive. And particularly it's being used by Chen Shui-bian. I mean, he now holds himself up as, you know, I'm the only one who supports Taiwan democracy and, you know, the hell with China and the United States. I'll do what I want to do. And this seems to be having some positive effect. Now, you're closer to it than I am. But people talk to me. We were, you know, Derek and I were just with a group of people from Taiwan in Tokyo, and they talked about rising anti-Americanism in Taiwan. So is this something you see as real?
I don't see any objective or scientific studies of this phenomenon emerging in Taiwan. In fact, if there is a rising anti-American sentiment in Taiwan, you will witness a lot of people continuously gathering in front of the AIT office in Taipei and shouting and demonstrating. And I don't see that happen. Even we have a very sensitive period right now, right? Occasionally, you see people protest, a farmers group, if there's a beef being imported and so forth, or rice being imported, whatever. That's common practice, in terms of these trade disputes. It's not anti-American sentiment. I don't see people are really getting this momentum. They're treating America as bullying in Taiwan, and they don't like it and so forth. Frustrated about this, I consider people still consider and cherish U.S.-Taiwan relations strongly, not only in terms of perception of defense guarantor, but also in terms of trade, in terms of other relations. We have a strong relations of trade. We have a strong relations of education and everything. You see how many people are applying for U.S. visa every year? A lot. People still like to come to America and visit and study. I mean, I think the relations still remain strong between two countries. All right. Not many people in Taiwan really get excited about what kind of offensive system, veteran system being developed by Taiwan. Yes, if you have it, fine. If you don't have, well, what else can we lose? We still have the United States supporting us. So that's their perception. And there's not much reports over the development of offensive systems. And other people consider it has been exaggerated and amply politicized as a sort of a psychological, retaliation against Chinese. It's not necessarily a credible weapon system, because lack of a nuclear tip, missiles, whatever, how can you, you know, coerce China or deter China in that way?
It's difficult. US concerns known?
US concerns are known, yes. And they consider this is perhaps the way to encourage the United States to release more advanced technology weapon systems to Taiwan. I think this is the way they treat it this way. Announcing Taiwan is developing offense systems, and more willingly, the United States is providing Taiwan more advanced technology and weapon systems. Look at what the Harpoon missiles, they just been approved by the DOD and Pentagon, the air-launched Harpoon missiles. That's one of the examples, which is similar to so-called the offensive cruise missile system developed by Taiwan. If that is the case, if you want to stop Taiwan to or discontinue what kind of offensive system, give us more adequate weapon system in your inventory. And I think people would want to see that happen, and that would be a strong symbol of U.S. support of Taiwan defense too.
So you see it mostly as a tool.
The question is, not many people really believe that we can actually fend off the mainland Chinese right. by developing offensive capability. Is it?
So why are they doing it, in your view? Is it simply as a tool?
It's a psychological coercion, and it's a sort of a reverse sentiment. We don't want to be sitting there and being attacked by mainland China. We have to come up with something to show our resistance. In a way, this is a symbol of resistance, of harassment from mainland China. You want to harm me, I can harm you too. And also, by showing this to the Chinese, say, don't mess up with us. You will get a bloody nose out of it if you want to attack Taiwan.
That's about all they're getting.
Yeah, that's right. What else can you do? We are a small country, you know. So they have to think of whatever they can develop and available to them. If you cannot get the advanced weapon system from the United States, then we should have a plan B with us. This is perhaps the plan B with us.
Yes, thank you. The first comment, Derek, you talked about voting in the LY. 2 years ago at the U.S.-Taiwan Business Council's annual defense industry conference in Phoenix, Vice Minister of Armament made a really good statement. He said that in Taiwan, there are less than 10,000 people outside the military who are involved in the defense industry. Less than 10,000. You got 225 legislators. Apply that to votes. It's almost nothing. So trying to get a legislator to vote for a weapon system versus social or whatever is really tough. That's the first thing. The second thing is every time that this issue about offensive weapons comes up, the first thing that comes to my mind is that on any given day, there's 2 million people from Taiwan on the mainland. Over 500,000 live in Shanghai. So Taiwan's going to fire a missile into Shanghai and kill its own people and maybe some Americans. What about the political ramifications of that? And nobody wants to address that issue. And then the last thing is, and I asked Derek this question in Oxford 3 years ago, and we still are discussing this, but it seems like about every war game, regardless of whether it's Taiwan or the U.S., typical scenario is Taiwan declares independence, mainland mobilizes, begins to attack, the U.S. comes in and saves the day. End of war game. And I'd like to take that another step and ask you this. It seems to me that I call this the day after the battle. And what do I mean by that? Forget about how this war started, how it's fought, but let's say the battle is over. There's only two outcomes for Taiwan. Taiwan wins or loses, depending on how you define that. But then look at the three actors, Taiwan, the U.S., and China. If Taiwan, if the U.S. comes in and quote-unquote saves the day and Taiwan wins, what does the U.S. do politically? Do we recognize an independent Taiwan? What do we do with Beijing, 1.3 billion people and everything that we do with them? Do we now put forces on Taiwan? What do we do with that? It's sort of looking at Iraq after the war. You know, what do we do? What happens if Beijing loses? Then what happens on the mainland? What happens to the Chinese Communist Party? What happens to the military? My personal view is that the PLA, if we think they're modernizing now, we haven't seen anything yet. If they lose, we haven't seen anything about modernization. It'll take them 10 years. They will really then, and everything will be Taiwan, not contingency. That will be the plan. And yeah, they may be hurt economically, but in my view, the PLA will throw away all the generals, and they'll come back with true nationalism and really build up its forces. Do we want that? How does the U.S. And ultimately, Taiwan is a loser. Taiwan is the ultimate loser. Taiwan's economy is based on exports, whatever percent it is. Taiwan's economy, the first missile hits Taiwan, their economy is down the tubes. And look what happened in 96. The first missiles in the stock market went down 26%. Lloyd's of London, you name it. Has Taiwan won? Have they lost? What's happened? And I really wish that all three sides, especially two sides, the U.S. and Taiwan, would really look at this from a reverse engineering standpoint. And is it worth doing some of the things that Taiwan is doing today if, in fact, after the battle, what are the consequences? And then you throw Japan in there and all of these things. And nobody seems to want to address going back this other way of the day after the battle. And I'd like your comments on this.
I think I sort of tend to agree with your assessments the day after. Yes, China will get as much nationalism as possible and come back again, because they will not allow these things to continue. And their regime is depending on this final results. And the regime survival is important. And the Chinese cannot lose a territory, because that's their national pride. So Taiwan will be suffering if this will be the case afterwards. I think people understand this mentality and culture, I mean, as far as I can see. Because after all, we share this Chinese culture on both sides. They understand the nationalism phenomena in many China, sentiments and so forth. That's the reason why I think this is why people are, by calculating the downsides and the upsides, advantages and disadvantages, still you see a lot of people supporting so-called the U.S.-defined status quo in terms of managing stability and security in that Taiwan Strait. Because after all, it is not winner-takes-all a situation in Taiwan. They understand that this could be the best way to manage peace and security. So the question, the debate is interesting in Taipei, very interesting right now. Whether, as far as Taiwan's national security is concerned, which one comes first, stability and peace in the Taiwan Strait or outright independent Taiwan status? I mean, which one is serving the best interest for the national security? I mean, that's another aspect for debate in the coming elections. I think more and more people are supporting this notion. I mean, even the ruling party themselves are thinking about how to develop peace and stability frameworks to managing the security in the Taiwan Strait. I think this is the only solution that people can come up with, the consensus in Taipei. So whoever can produce a workable solution, a formula to managing a long-term peace and security situation in Taiwan, he will get elected and he will be supported. Nobody wants to see the war happen in Taiwan Strait. Nobody wants to see Taiwan suffer as a result of this miscalculation or misperception. But the point is, we want to remain our current political status without Beijing's intervention. We want to protect our own national interests with our own defense postures. We want to continue this participation actively in international activities. We don't want to be isolated. If we want to maintain peace and stability in Taiwan Strait, so all in the good sides. So these are the abundantly clear messages across the board. If you ask everybody in Taiwan, this will be the areas for consensus building, which means it's not war for Taiwan's people. It's a peace building process. So I think Beijing should really understand, really touch the ground in Taiwan, really reach the minds and hearts of the Taiwanese people. If you want to come up with a real interpretation of what people are thinking and what should drive in the political forces in the future, this will be the area for you to pay attention to.
Sir, I'm Tom Russell, one of the military fellows here at CSIS, and I thank you for this opportunity to come and talk to you today. I'm going to try to sneak in two questions, too, if I may. The first is, you threw out some interesting statistics in regards to the feelings of the Taiwanese people, and then you also said that 80% probably don't fully comprehend the U.S., the true U.S. Intents vis-a-vis Taiwan. I assume, sir, that you are one of the 20%, though, that do comprehend. And I would like to pose those three questions to you specifically in terms of whether you believe China would use force, whether you believe that Taiwan could defend itself against China, and whether you believe that the U.S. would intervene if Taiwan were attacked by China. The second question I wanted to throw out is that China has articulated five circumstances in which they would use force against Taiwan. Formal declaration of independence, acquisition of nuclear weapons, foreign intervention, internal unrest. But they also said that one of the circumstances was an indefinite delay in the settlement of the issue. 1949 was a long time ago. As generations pass, a stronger separate identity evolves within Taiwan. How long is indefinite? How long, in terms of that particular circumstance, is China willing to wait? Those are two questions, sir. Thank you.
First question, yes, I do believe that if there is a serious tip of the balance of the military situation in the Taiwan Strait and tipping off to Beijing's side, there is a chance to encourage the PRA or the old Beijing's leadership to consider the use of force, because if they consider this is the passage of convenience to push for unification, there is a chance for there. So we cannot allow Beijing to come up with that kind of ideas. So I think the United States is doing the best way to constantly warning Beijing, do not think of using force, even there is a tip of the balance in the Strait. And, it's, of course, at the same time, urging Taipei do not taking advantage of the situation and divert the responsibility to the United States, not to Taiwan. I mean, because Taiwan should face the situation and do something about its own defense. And I consider we should take a serious position to consider to reconsolidate our defense postures. And I do believe the presidential candidates who are competing against 2008 presidency, they will spend time to look into this issue as well. As far as I know, one candidate already seriously looking at the issue and probably will come up with his ideas or formula to implement the defense policies in the future by September. And I consider he is in favor of consolidation.
Can you identify who that candidate is?
Well, not the gentleman just visiting Washington, D.C.
Yes. That'd be mine, Joe.
Well, second question. I don't think Chinese are really remembering all kinds of conditions they put forward in terms of to use force. I think the way they put in this statements, indefinite delay of the unification issue, is a sign of incompetence, a lack of confidence themselves. I think Beijing leadership or Beijing's policymakers, they should come up with more confidence today than used to be. I mean, that statement has been made in Jiang Zemin era. But if you look at Mr. Hu Jintao, the current president, I mean, in the future, if they build up more confidence in terms, not only in terms of dealing with Taiwan issue, but also in terms of how to deal with China as a influential power in the world. If they can come up with that, such confidence, they will have more patience in terms of dealing with this issue in the long run. After all, I don't think Taiwan is still high in agenda. As long as Taiwan do not challenging or step over the red lines, and they can live with the so-called define the status quo to managing peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait. I think that's still high in Chinese policy agenda, and that will be the overlapping area for future.
Can I just add one thing? I would encourage you, if you're interested in understanding how the Chinese look at this, and I would agree with Andrew that the what you quoted, I think, is from the white paper that was published, was it 2000, right? Really, that really does represent, I think, Jiang Zemin's thinking about the circumstances under which China would use force. And in 2005, when the Chinese passed the anti-secession law, there was a sort of updating of this. Now, it does not supplant what was presented in 2000, but nevertheless, I think they are trying to define more specifically and for the purpose of the law under what circumstances they would use force. But China's red lines, in my view, are fungible. They are not something set in stone. There are factors, particularly U.S. policy, attitudes of the international community, their own assessment of domestic stability in China, all of those things, I think, shape how they would respond at any given point in time. And there is no sort of clearly defined red line. And in some ways, that's the problem, because that goes to the issue of the potential for miscalculation, because we're not really sure where the red line is. Taiwan certainly isn't really sure where the red line is. And when you throw in factors like the 17th Party Congress coming up and, you know, the Olympics, and then all those things change China's calculations. And so it's very much a moving target.
In September. If not, same point, I'll turn to our list.
Three areas he's interested in and perhaps put more emphasis on. One is continue this defense reform in Taiwan. Maybe we'll, you know, the way the objective is try to create a lean and mean and strong armed forces. Downsizing certainly is on the agenda, and encouraging more talented and more highly educated young people to go to the military. That means there will be increase of salary.
What kind of downsizing?
The total force.
Total force downsizing.
Yeah. So the continuation of defense reform will be on the agenda, too. And secondly, regarding the procurement, I think he will not miss the point, the opportunity to look into the adequate and the suitable defense articles for Taiwan's defense in the future. I think resolute defense is his objective. And also, do not send a strong, a wrong signal to China that Taiwan is easily to be attacked by Beijing. So in that case, I think that he will put emphasis on building adequate defense. You know, that doesn't relate to specific articles that he is going to promote in the future. And the third area, I think, is that he wants to create a military that are really supported by the people. I mean, morale is another area to be concerned about. But you consider there is not a high morale in Taiwan, in a way. Not necessarily with regard to loyalty issue. But he can see the military should be highly respected because they are the professionals. they have the abundant, clear mission to protect the country, and it should be respected that way. And that's the way to boost the morale among the military. So he wants to create adequate soldier status for the military personnel and boost the morale, not just increasing salaries, but they want to have adequate soldier status. And, of course, the military has to come up with adequate professionalism to cope with the future demands. So that would be the three areas for his defense agenda in the future.
Thanks. Steve Flanagan. Andrew, thank you. I was disheartened to hear Bonnie's comment that people on the mainland are once again probing about the possible U.S. reaction to limited attacks against Taiwan, as we heard a lot, in, I think, in 2003-2004. And, of course, the canonical, or the one that I think has animated a lot of people's concern, has been the notion of some kind of special forces decapitating attack against Taiwan to disrupt your defense preparations. But the other thing that I think that we've seen increasingly bold activities in the last few years is the cyber threat and the way in which both Taiwan and the United States, whether they're patriotic hackers or under the control of the Ministry of State Security, I don't know. It does seem to me that those array of threats are very potentially disruptive and, in a sense, a way that would not create lots of manifestations that would rally American public opinion or even, you know, it was called mass confusion in Taiwan and not necessarily strengthen the U.S. public resolve, the idea that maybe something is really amiss. And I wonder, how has that played, that sense of these rather ambiguous kinds of attacks that would be disruptive, might break the will of the Taiwanese people? How has that, has that been discussed much in the political discourse? And do you see there's been any progress on sort of hardening Taiwan's command and control infrastructure? I mean, has the LY been supportive of efforts in that area?
I think information attack, we don't call it a cyber attack, but the way that China is going to conduct information attack over Taiwan is certainly has brought the attention not only from the AOY, but also from the military armed forces as well. A lot of experiences emerged that China do use the cyber attack to try to steal information out of our computer systems or government information system as well. There are passive preventive measures being adopted to prevent this information stealing process or attacking the computer systems. There are efforts made by the legislative yuan in terms of asking or demanding the military to provide hard evidence for this protecting the information networks. In the process of defense construction and procurement. Specifically, I think that if you look into the Legislative Gazette, the proceedings in the Subcommittee of Defense in the last two sessions, especially last session, people are specific, legislators specifically asking the questions about the, we have these resolute projects cooperating with the United States to reinforce the information system in Taiwan, the community command control system, C4I system, building up for Taiwanese. They just completed the phase one and beginning with the phase two construction. And legislators are asking the MND whether this kind of cooperation of C4I construction really involving protection systems, fending off the cyber attack from mainland China and so forth. So they are concerned about whether the building the command and control system will really, survive the Chinese cyber attack. So they are paying extra attention to these efforts. And I think if there will be measures to be adopted to prevent and in need of resources allocation, I think legislative yuan will support these efforts in the future.
I'm Dan Murphy, one of the military fellows here at CSIS, and thanks for coming. I want to kind of circle back to the specifics of missile defense, perhaps. I was a little bit discouraged in your discussion of the kind of all-or-nothing approach to missile defense. You know, the numbers are on their side. We can't possibly spend enough money to match the numbers on their side, because perhaps not most likely, not most dangerous, but most likely would be some sort of limited strike along some sort of escalation ladder. And the question I have would be, is there room in this, you know, rational discussion that you mentioned for a place for high-end missile defense in the context of countering a coercive strategy by the PRC? And if so, which party do you think has the ability to have that and convince the public? If the public is, 70% that they're not ready, but they also say 70% that they won't use force, who's going to convince them that the Chinese might not view force the way the Taiwanese view force, that a limited missile strike may not constitute a use of force in a Chinese thought process, but may indeed achieve the PRC's objective? So missile defense seems to me a very niche capability that one could invest in and achieve effect, whether it's to slow the escalation ladder, a deterrent effect, perhaps even slow the escalation ladder to overcome the geography that you have. I mean, most of them believe that we're going to enter on the Taiwanese side. The Pacific's an awfully big place, and it takes a little bit of time to get there, even if you're ready to go. And it seems to me that anything they could do as a stopgap, and missile defense fits right in that. And just your specific comments on that. Thanks.
Thank you. I think people agree that we they are not against limited missile defense in Taiwan. If you look at the debate and discussions, building limited missile defense system is not against by the legislative yuan or by the population. Therefore, the budget or resources to allocate money to build or to buy limited numbers of missile batteries to protect key areas, political, economic, or military centers in Taiwan, agreed and approved as well. However, the concern is that people are debating, if you only protect the political center, economic center, or the military key points, what about the lives of people? I mean, the population is considering that. Okay, if you only want to cover 2 million people's lives, how many missiles you want to have? And people want to, they are taxpayers, they say, we demand some, protections. We deserve some protections from our national defense resources allocations. So that's the kind of dilemma we have. So if you're arguing for more resources to put into a missile defense system, and people say, can you protect me? I mean, if you only protect the assets, can you protect people's life? And that's the kind of argument in the air. The other, I was still emphasizing this, is that and they still consider that it will be difficult for China to use missile attack, even limited strikes. If we can use the hardening process, protecting our key assets, and that will fend off the first wave of limited strikes, and they cannot succeed, and we can survive, and we can continue our life, and we can still waiting for U.S. to come to our rescue or come to assist us. We can hold on to the situation for 2 weeks. China cannot succeed in conducting amphibious attack over Taiwan. So we'll be much better off. Even we suffer a little bit, but we can have a lot of to play with. That's another source on the agenda, too. And third one, densely populated. And we still have a lot of foreigners, expatriates, live in Taipei. And the missiles are not so accurate, only hitting the hardware, and you have collateral damages. Life can be suffered, and so forth. So, if the foreigners continue to stay in Taiwan, there will be a big, a human shield and fending off the Chinese attacks too. So they will think twice. If they cannot hit the hardware target, they will kill people and even kill the foreigners, and that will produce a lot of uncertainties in terms of the reactions from United States, from Japan, or from European community. And China will suffer from that too. international embargo sanctions were immediately followed. So people consider that in terms of using missiles, even limited strikes, it would be a difficult decision for leadership. Well, I don't know, but that's the kind of argument in the air.
Jerry Hyman at CSIS. I want to get to the question of the miscalculations, the possible miscalculations that we were talking about earlier. In the late 60s, the first Prime Minister of Malaysia, Tunku Abdul Rahman, was also the defense minister, and he was in a press conference, and they asked him about, there was a particularly belligerent period, and they asked him whether he had a plan in case China attacked Malaysia. And he said, well, of course, I'm the defense minister. Of course I have a plan. He said, well, could you share it with us? He said, yes, we're going to surrender. And it was a realistic view of what Malaysia's options were against a Chinese attack. And I wonder if you could give us some advice on the U.S. side as to what the Secretary of State or the President could say, recognizing the sensitivities and the national interests of Taiwan. What could the U.S. do to engender a more realistic view of what a U.S. response would look like? Because if people of Taiwan think that under any circumstances the U.S. would come to its defense, that may be a tremendous miscalculation. In other words, if the U.S. said, well, you guys tweak the tiger, which is what Tunku Abdul Rahman said, we're not going to tweak the tiger. That's one of the things we're going to do under my plan, not going to tweak the tiger. If Taiwan appears to be going over the lines that would be considered sort of an unreasonable step by Taiwan, the U.S. potentially, notwithstanding its legal obligations under, wouldn't have a legal obligation under any circumstances. So could you give us some suggestions to what the U.S. could do to signal how it would react if it felt that Taiwan were moving too far in tweaking the tiger of China?
In terms of address directed to the Taiwanese public, I think U.S. should come up with a more clear messages, not ambiguous strategies or repeating very abstractive statements regarding U.S. Taiwan policy or China policy. United States should come up with a very specific and clear, abundantly clear messages about what should be done in terms of the limitations of U.S. obligations. I think the limitation of U.S. obligations should be abundantly clear address to the Taiwanese population. And let them understand there is a limits for United States to come up with their commitments. As I mentioned, that still a lot of people, majority of people in Taiwan believe that the United States will support the democracy and will support Taiwan whatever it takes. As President Bush has mentioned in 2000, that word, whatever it takes, was abundantly clear, ringing in the ear, in the ears in Taiwanese still. They still believe the United States can come up with all kinds of supports to Taiwan without any condition attached to it. Therefore, I think the abundant clear message to convey to the Taiwanese, there are limits that U.S. can do about the situation. And primarily, this is protecting U.S. interests. It's not protecting other people's interests. U.S. interest comes first. I think a lot of people people in Taiwan consider Taiwan's interest is overlapping with U.S. interest. That's not necessarily so. Okay. In some areas, we have overlapping interests, but in some other areas, we do not have overlapping interests. That's normal in among countries, even allies and so forth. So I think that kind of, what U.S. can do about it. What are the limitations? I think the United States has a responsibility to make it clear to the general public in Taiwan. I'm not sure whether they will convince Taiwanese to believe, but at least they have an opportunity to listen directly to the messages conveyed by the U.S. Government in that regard. That's my answer.
I'd just like to comment on the premise of your question, and I'm sure other people around the table have different views. But my sense is that regardless of what Taiwan did to provoke a conflict, that the United States would respond. There's a range of responses that we might have, but I don't think we would sit by and do nothing and saying, you know, you deserve it. You've provoked the Chinese attack. I think the major issue for the United States is our credibility in the region, that we just cannot sit by and let Taiwan use force. Let China use force. Yes, right. Again, Taiwan's not going to start the war, just politically. We are not going to let China use force in any way against Taiwan or probably potentially in other ways. And give the message to the rest of the world that our interests are not being damaged. And I think particularly this would have great implications for Japan. And my guess is that in 1996, when we sent carriers to the region in response to China's firing of missiles toward Taiwan, that was foremost in the minds of people who made that decision, that we want the Japanese to understand that we are our alliance, our commitments are reliable and credible. Other countries in the region as well, as obviously we have very important defense relationships in the region with other countries. So this is sort of, in my view, an unfortunate reality that Taiwan is to some extent right, that no matter how politically stupid they are, that we probably will respond to restore the status quo ante. At least that's, I think, what I think our political objectives would be. Mike, you want to come back at me on that?
It's an extremely difficult balance. That's why the policy of ambiguity was pursued for so long.
Just comment that what I think Bonnie has voiced is what I call the credibility trap that the U.S. has in dealing with Taiwan. And my response to dealing with that is that we don't want to find ourselves in a position where we are forced to make some kind of decision on how to respond. And that, I think, underlines the importance of us continuing to do two things. One, tell the PRC not to use force, but two, to be very explicit that we do not have a legal obligation to come to Taiwan's defense in a military way. We may have a political obligation to deal with this in some fashion, but Rich Armitage's statement a couple of years ago when he tried to put on the public record that even as a very close friend of Taiwan, and supporter of a strong relationship with Taiwan, he tried to remind people in Taiwan that the TRA does not obligate us to come to Taiwan's defense militarily. I would like to see that as a more frequent part of U.S. comments on policy than it's been, because I do believe you're absolutely right that when people in Taiwan think of American policy, what they remember more than anything else is the president's statement, whatever it takes. And the president hasn't walked that back, despite the fact of his comments when Wang Jiabao was here. He did not walk that statement back, and I wish he would have.
I would just kind of go back to some of my comments very much at the beginning, understanding what has been said here about ambiguity and the TRA. Nevertheless, we're talking about what is the role of Taiwan? What is its legitimacy in the international system? Does it have a right to exist? What would be the implications of the use of military force by another country in the Western Pacific region? It seems to me those are very serious questions. And we should not, I think, be so ambiguous in our approach to this that we blur these issues and perhaps even what our responses might be. I would take a little bit different tact to some of the things that I've heard.
Mike Fonte. Hi, Andrew. Good to see you. My tie gives me away. I have prejudices here, and so I admit to those up front. There's blue in there, yeah. Let me just add one more. I think the U.S. has been increasingly willing to say some strong things about what it thinks about defending Taiwan. Jim Kelly in his 04, Bob Zelik in more recently, and interestingly, Congress has gotten into the act with John Warner's statements about provocation. I think the messages may not have been as clear as the Taiwanese need to hear them, but they've been there. I want to go off on a little different track, which you won't surprise you, which is when Mr. Ma came a year plus ago, he impressed people here by saying he was going to put a defense budget on the table, and then it never happened. So I guess the question I have, you know, again, with my prejudiced point of view here, is do you see him, I mean, you gave a very good three-point analysis of what he may do here in terms of his defense posture. But, I mean, I guess I'd like to hear what your sense is. There's some sense that he feels, and perhaps this is a green misperception, that he wants to keep an equidistant position between China and the United States. And you know, it puts him in an interesting place for what his perception of the threat is, which is what you're talking about here today, and where he thinks a defense of Taiwan has to go forward. So there's a bunch of questions involved around that. I guess the basic question is, will he come back and lay that kind of defense posture on the table before he, before the election, do you think?
As far as I can see, he mentally tried to develop Taiwanese defense as a sort of a hard rock defense. It will be difficult for China to swallow if they try to chewed up, and they will get a bloody, mouse or whatever. So that's a concept he's tried to consolidate the defense postures in Taiwan. So make it harder for China, difficult to swallow and to chew up. And they will, if they want to swallow it, and they will choke the Chinese. So that's the kind of way to fend off the Chinese use military. Secondly, I think he repeatedly emphasized that he would not talk to the Chinese unless they withdraw the missiles. I think that's very, very important for Chinese for Ma Ying-jeou's political overtures in terms of dealing with China in the future. He would not discuss any peaceful arrangement with Beijing with a gun pointing at the Taiwanese hands. That's for sure. But anyway, how is he going to do that? I don't have the further information for that, but the way that he is trying to build up the defense for Taiwan in the future is to put Taiwan in a position that's a hard rock defense. That it will be difficult for Beijing to attack and to swallow and chew up if they attempt to do so.
Never thought of mine, Joe.
No, I'm sorry. I'm in self-imposed exile because I'm late. I'm sorry. And I'm sorry I missed the initial presentation, but the discussion was interesting and I think revealing. Bonnie's right. The U.S. looking not only at the Western Pacific but global commitments to allies and security would risk a loss of you know what theorists call hegemonic stability if we didn't respond forcefully to a Chinese use of force. But as someone pointed out, that doesn't necessarily mean military response. There's a range of options, and the Undersecretary of Defense about 10 years ago, Walt Slocum, said our response would be incalculable to the Chinese, which really impressed them. But the beauty of that is it's incalculable. That's right. Consequences are incalculable. Yeah. So and that I think is a point that's frequently missed, at least in much of the discussion. In any contingency planning, you look at various phases of the contingency, and much of the political discussion is about phases 1, 2, and 3. You know, whether you survive the attack, what you do after the attack, and there's simply not enough attention to what's called phase 0, which is the pre-hostility phase. And what we do in the U.S. and what we do with Taiwan or others to deter and dissuade China from using force. And another way of putting that is to make any planning so complicated that it wouldn't be worth it. And our goal should be to make it too hard for any PLA chief to go to Hu Jintao or anyone and say, yeah, we could do this and survive the consequences. In terms of that phase 0, the dissuasion and deterrence, I think, frankly, I'll take a shot at both camps. Pan Green has done damage to Taiwan's security by pushing the envelope on independence. The result being that the U.S., Australia, Japan, other natural allies for Japan, whose intentions China will watch when calculating the costs of using force, that those allies, including the U.S., have taken steps that are unprecedented in non-support of Taiwan. In APEC, we've not supported the Taiwan's candidate. In WHO, they're backing off. Now, it's small steps, but if this trend continues, that will undermine stability and weaken dissuasion and deterrence in phase 0, because in terms of intentions, it looks like the Western democracies, and especially the U.S. and Japan, don't care that much about Taiwan. So that's dangerous. But the Pan Blue has done damage, and I have to also express some concern about what I'm hearing, because the other side of dissuasion and deterrence is demonstrating a readiness to defend Taiwan and a readiness to complicate the other side's planning. And things like missile defense or anti-submarine warfare don't have to be 100% effective. They just have to be enough to complicate the planning, to make the barrier higher. And this part is really important, to demonstrate that the U.S. and Taiwan are on the same page. And the problem with not increasing defense spending is it looks to Beijing like we're not on the same page. And you'll have a real, an equally damaging signal to Beijing that we don't have a common view of how we would defend Taiwan if it came to that. And by the way, that extends to Japan, where there are increasing concerns about this as well. So I just end with that, a pox on everyone's house. Even though my name's Green, I'm trying to be equally... hopefully the next president of Taiwan, whoever it is, will find a way to think and talk with the U.S. about this dissuasion and deterrence piece and what combination of steps, including increasing defense spending, but also what steps Taiwan takes in terms of identity to fit Taiwan's needs. And I think the identity issue is legitimate, but to do it in a way that makes it harder for the PLA and complicates their planning. So I just to end with that thought. Sorry I was late. Appreciate your being
here. Really appreciate your comments, and I totally agree with your evaluations and suggestions. I think, yeah, we should take both issues together to look at the a much bigger horizon in the future. And don't send the wrong message to PRA. I mean, that's the primary issue we have to deal with. Yes.
Well, I thought the thing that Mike Fonte raised, which I think has been said by some blue, maybe Ma Ying-jeou, that take a more equidistant path between China and the United States, that to me is a fundamental miscalculation of what our approach is to Taiwan.
Has that actually been articulated, or is that your interpretation of what it is? That's right.
Nobody
on the other side has said that.
No. Privately, I've heard this has been said. And I've certainly seen it through the academics, but I've also heard it from official. Official has said that kind of idea. So this is something that if it's effectuated, again, as a representation of miscalculation, misunderstanding of the United States.
Right.
So this is...
South
Yeah, right. They pulled back. A little more dangerous in the Taiwan context. We're going to have a lot more discussion on Taiwan here at CSIS, I'm sure, around town with the various other think tanks represented over the next year through March and then through May with a new administration in Taiwan. And if politics of the United States heats up as well, the China issue will heat up. So we'll hope to see you back here. And please join me in thanking Andrew for coming out.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, hope to see you again and learn from your wisdom in the future. Thank you so much.
Thank you.